Welcome to the Ryle Books Podcast, an archival space for the readings and conversations that we host in our bookshop and project space in Brussels. Today we have the pleasure of sharing the recording of a reading by US-based poet Farid Metuk, followed by a conversation with Brussels-based writer Philip Jacob. The event took place in our space in Brussels on June 15th earlier this year. I might get started now. Thank you all for coming this afternoon. And thank you to Farid for being here and also to Philip. This event also is in large part thanks to Philip for introducing Farid's work to us at Ryle and then for making this connection. So thank you for that. I will just give a very brief introduction and then hand over to the two of you. A queer writer of Syrian and Peruvian heritage, Farid Metuk has lived in the US since the age of six, first as an undocumented person and then as a quote-unquote legal resident and now as a quote-unquote naturalized citizen. He is the author of poetry collections titled This is a Nice Neighborhood and The Real Horse and of several chapbooks. His work has been anthologized in The Best American Experimental Poetry, in Angels of the Americlips, an anthology of New Latinx writing, and the Library of America's Latino Poetry, a new anthology, amongst various other publications. Metuk's poems can be found in journals including The Nation, The Boston Review, Denver Quarterly, Poetry, Bomb Magazine, Lana Turner Journal, and The Paris Review. Today, Farid will read new poems from his forthcoming collection, Moon Mirrored Indivisible. The poems explore the aesthetic perversions of syntax and rhyme to search for yet unrealized perversions and purities amidst national, sexual, and ancestral orthodoxies. Philip Jacob writes and edits columns, fiction, essays, and celebrity profiles. He is a contributing editor at LA-based Flaunt magazine. He read Who Wants It How, his three-month gossip, culture, and sex column installment at Spare Wheel in Brussels. He also regularly writes for his Substack, Salt Over Gold, which I really recommend people subscribing to. And he's read his fiction at Cellar Door in Brussels and David Horvitz Garden in Los Angeles. He is currently writing the draft of his first novel, and he develops ideas by writing notes on his phone during morning runs. He was born in Slovakia and is currently based in Brussels, Belgium. So thank you both so much, Farid and Philip, for joining us today. We'll hand over the microphone first to Farid, and then we'll join the two of you in conversation. Thank you.
That's the best poem you'll hear tonight. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for being here, and thank you, Philip, for making it happen. I want to start by rescuing this old poem from this out-of-print chapbook. It's called Rodin Said Each Thing is Merely the Limit of the Flame to Which It Owes Its Existence. Rodin said each thing is merely the limit of the flame to which it owes its existence. And this collection is all addressed to my daughter, so that's the you in here. The big window in your room holds its lawn, lamps, light, and tree forms. Irritate the night with what tenderness and utter terror at losing you. Dare say we live on money, even with the fine pissy smell around our toilet. Sunset tonight in layered and impacted lines. Above us, rendered by or under the inspection of flies bred from bees and wind abrade our skin. The baby monitor feathers ocean waves on loop over the ocean waves. Sand crabs are waiting in plastic habitats at the five and dime, carrying little stars and stripes, little sunsets and hovering gulls painted on their shells. Into a future guaranteed for some time by a new protocol of tasks. In our quiet talk before sleep, all four of our parents up in the ether and all two of yours. From our toes and heels, rub off the rind of blisters and adhesions of the day. One thing is a festival dancer of Bissau in a mask of white skin, being an astronaut, being the future. One thing is a Louisiana convict daring a bull in the Angola prison rodeo, being a cowboy, being free. And that, along with my first book, This Is a Nice Neighborhood, are available. There's a couple of copies back there. We were going to get the real horse, but it couldn't get here on time. So I just brought what I had. This book, Moon Mirrored Indivisible, will be out in February of 25 from the University of Chicago Press. Getting the notes ready in case I need. Cool. Redolent. I'm alone, I'm told, and decorated in English script, with eyes available with no claim to the words, but with flowers on flowers shipped from Bogota's savannah, helping me talk as one of a people with occasions to mark, rolling about each other, viscously having forgotten the mannered European flower code. I bring the right bouquet, free of reference to the local eucalyptus, leaves, or bright dogs that range at night. The ground floor of my position holds no dictionary or science that can really name the flowers. I'm not pointing, because they're so obviously opening. Even then, trying to stop being these people, I'm not alone saying back something like dark of flowers or stones to swallow. We're not inside the words. No interviews. This begins with an epigraph from my friend, the Palestinian poet Fadi Judah. It's called The Game. But I'm closer to you than you are to yourself, and this, my enemy friend, is the definition of distance. Fadi Judah. The child's game on our walk was to say Spain in various intonations and rhythms. We were to respond France, but with the previous nation's effects mimicked exactly so, assigned unoriginal countries, disturbing two hawks into flight as we went. All done, the child said, of the distance the hawk's eyes traveled to get to her. And if in some memory she already knows distance is the force holding words together, so they're free to stay near. We have ridden away on Near's back, waving goodbye and welcome, exactly as a people coming closer. The Butcher's Fifth Quarter, which I learned from Stanley Tucci, is Italian slang for the cheap meat at the butcher's. Right? If names are the child's song reached anonymous graves in the countries we left, would their fields of dirt listen, no position needed, no future needed at the susceptible horizon behind us. I accept rage, driven up the nose, crevices of the whole head, really, and lip, liver and asshole, tonguing the edge in the glass that dying opens. But a people would trade the butcher's cheap meat for stones to toss through their reflections. The first is sleep. The second, industry dismissed. The third and fourth stones are missing. The fifth is having resisted steeping so casually in pain, the sixth stone, that its stench would trigger no memory. At the seventh, drink what water you need. At least one of the stones tends to be last light, The eighth is bed sheets on the couch, any fold, a niche, opening a crevice to carry the voice. Stalwart, swallowed, wavering. On the ninth stone, we bear you out from those countries' sanctified plots toward us. The orders, the orders. On the tenth stone, closer to us. I live in Arizona near an Air Force base, which is the only background you need for this poem. Closer. If it's freedom or Sunday morning, through which the iterations, UH-60 Black Hawk, A-10 Warthog, C-130E, MH-60S Nighthawk, HC-130J Combat King 2, E-3 Sentry, E-6B Mercury, EC-130H Compass Call, F-4 Phantom, F-16 Fighting Falcon, F-22 Raptor, B-25 Bomber 55 ECG Carrier. Fly closer. A clear sky, a perfect day, can be a backdrop so calm, admitting no wind. So who'll take that feeling with me into the critique of feeling? This is called Before That, and the only note for this poem, I guess, is that there's a quotation from The Theory of the Young Girl by the collective, the Tikkun Collective, translated from French into English by my friend Ariana Rains. And I guess I pick a fight with them in this poem. Before that, right, where were you born before that is the question often asked of immigrants. I want to talk to you about happiness to stay inside it. But boys displaced by proxy war are falling onto gravel outside my window under the police helicopter's searchlight. The gravel bites through to the knees. The searchlight is a thing. The bars on the window are promised to. And the wisdom of the body, like articulations of capital through time, means some things, but not others. The greatest good in feeling, say, or how shitting to a news video of a beheading loosens my jaw. Nature compels cleanliness. I could aspire to be professional, sitting on the toilet and working a little snot, dry and fine. Tensile for new figuring, like I'm the god who knows. Mercury shifts shape, not category. Offal, organic, decorative. Maybe those are stages of consequence. Tended, the snot worked thin as a pencil mustache invites the strangeness of a decorated face, which blended with certain American things like shitting without a video is boring. But where were you born before that? Free radicals, the Tikkun Collective for one, at a click past Imperium turn back to describe Imperium's outlines but not their own posed facial stunts. A thing being a position, and it's grimacing. I mean, I can pair the sass of saying, quote, ultimately, it's the omnipresence of the new police that has made the war undetectable, with a laughter in the closed set of my laughters, each coded to an aspect and color and digital charm in the pocket. Watching this one, I'm learning to thicken the line between inner and outer cop, to follow a desert's turns toward the sun and its shielding waxes on leaves and with its needles. But where were you born before that? Forgive me for being so dumb, with this booger mustache so dark, having carried a little blood at the start. I guess if you're taken for a man, the old way was to say whatever men say, only louder. So even dead, you're seen in the distance, your words mark and redeem. Happy among the released. So tutored, so iterated, I might think any consoling magic could be an actual turn. But the night sky behaves itself as ordinance withheld, so that boys married to their own white father would lay in bed hardly saying prepossessed. George Zimmerman is the Peruvian-American who killed the young boy Trayvon Martin in Florida. All right, you lightheaded fathers. I'd ask for rain. Wait until January because I'll be born with a sash. This is where you shit. This, I'm told, is a drawer for aftershave. Knowing things, systems that churn hundreds of years, earns harrowing honors that get smeared. Some of it sticks. I mean, I could make believe a thing exists like a pine cone opening. But for daddy's spit, is it also the tree's many a small mouth? I hear of sovereignties. I hear of the first world, but having survived facing off with the progeny, ancestors, I'm told, are no prophylactics against it. In our bodies, there are no borders, the new Aeromexico ad says. So here come the killers and their rhetors. John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Juan Zarate of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here, I'm told, is a song. George Zimmerman, whose countrymen? Prepossessed. I thought, wrote cheers at the gate for each next fighter jet touching the commercial runway, meant there's a pith inside any moment available to the state that wants to be taken to with the balance point of intention and reception lucid dreamers must have. To thread a shared feeling through gelatin in the eye lights hollows, an alibi. But now that the sun in the scene is setting as in Los Angeles, long, thin band of orange between purple plains, it's more as if only a thought ago we'd been carefree under the vastest of honesties. August 2, 1990, until February 28, 1991. Those are the dates that the United States government recognizes as the length of the first war in Iraq. I was also in high school at that time and saw many boys wearing a t-shirt with the American flag that said, "Try and burn this one." Well-worn, resisting a tender regard wherein all else, must else, or else. A bold slogan carried forth, burn this one on the spiraling way of apostrophe. Cursed without cause, someone being called as the placeholder for the conscript. Try and burn this one, flag and word, on a white boy's t-shirt, I read the invitation to come close. So sociable, the sentence. exchanging styles, the sounds and colors of my face for his face, pressed into air's ravines, glancing into wind's crevices, packed with foreign or neighborly dead, else the local peace. A sentence covers with discretion, already fallen through the air of having survived men by engendering, pouring men into men, so begotten by just being around. Quote, in language we inherit the voices of the dead, Nathaniel Mackey said. And where else, if I ask so, having been said so, blushing, off leash? Did your t-shirt want me to follow? The sentence hoped how many would try. I'm going to sit here all day in the piece you made and write about it. All the times and tenses in the sentence, unread, your old t-shirt, alone, getting dressed, a little morning cold about your shoulder. Walking past, reading the t-shirt, had been inviting, not the t-shirt, but the print, will invite, accepting, going to try, will have been trying, etc. If you have to ask, etc., light this one. Fires vacuum thinking it's the space the invitation cared to fill. Like a dream where every sign tells me you're dangerous, thinks that waking life would listen. I lean into the promise in the sentence. Try to survive telling you you are a good man because you have peaceful energy. The dream trying to wish this truth into you as one incarnate, as one representative. But placeholders and conscripts helix through time and tense. This one volunteer trying on a sentence, then another friendly trying, being punished for trying, did try, will have been thought to be trying, inviting, dressing in a promise doubles back to will have had nothing to wear but punishment. Are any of you into hypno porn? Hypnotic porn has an audio track. Spiraling. One subgenre of hypno porn is satanic hypno porn. And so this is in the voice of the devil. Sentences heard upon emergent devotions. Having been called a mammon, a Belial, the devil aspects of dark to whom you would dedicate a man in himself, I appear close enough to consciousness to taste what words would go to what mouths. Don't call it ingenious use of the materials and signs that would carry this thinly distributed body until imagination abandons, leaving the most basic of men, auto-tuned, strobe-affected, hypno-video-voiced, coaching popper huffs to narrow the world into something you can swallow, yourselves down and out, recycling piss in perfect loops. Transaction pleased? Can you speak? I don't care enough to hear you, but I do enough to look and see you receiving what night and wind, gravel dust and easement lights over the safe and private yard. Will you heal? What do you think you're asking? You dress me in horns, in tongues, in muscles. You take only one light from my eyes. You rage. You remember to breathe. You use and wipe and smear. You think the mountain is rising, decorated in its metals. Your dreams take you into small rooms to come. The wind finally gets free enough to run through you, and you think it rushes at a hillside that must lift my throne. The raven visits, always over your left shoulder, and you are so grateful to be in its downcast yellow eye. Concentric. Set low under angels, orders of drones, expositors, I don't know who or what, if I look up, I might offend. However mannered the poem dares write about the poem, I'm fool enough to say it flattens and folds heaven's domes into fibers, stitched through whatever ear and out into a commonness, something unshrinkable being promised us, never miniature enough from minimum, a red mineral illuminating the old manuscripts with pictures and filigree through air, a voice would splice and bind, passing for surgery. What so goes? Do any of you know how to cruise for sex? Where did you learn to cruise? This is where I learned to cruise. In college, in the sauna at the gym. What so goes, having leaned to sex from me, to a nation's ears runs back as the plangency. Wrung from what goods or boys such a curious people might hope to chamber. And one I knew, if he cared to hold, what he saw of me, trying what type, young thing, without being severe. Therein delicate clappers kiss wet the sides of what words, nut and pig, spit and rim, pastoral heritage hills. Speak usefully, believe in beauty, knowing our values. Silent, his eyes coached once, which white to follow from the sauna to the stalls. Anonymous, learning, we sat in steam, not choosing each other. Until we allowed, wherein did go what words that led might come urgently onto his thigh. Having learned to want to be young things in a continuous tense. Knowing who to follow, to lay there a path outside, to ride on dry air over freedom wrung out in the cant of its advocates, expositors. He knew, I think, sitting apart we were things and labor, dissolved together our salty peasantries could sound that chamber's nadir. I'll finish with just two more poems. Mary's hymn of praise from the Gospel of Luke. She magnifies the Lord in her song, but also in her physical bearing of the child, the fetus. And it's called the Magnificat. Magnificat, mirror petition. Like mirrors, fear the seen, but travel in them. I look for eyes fierce enough to move a love into me as far as Mother Mary's Magnificat carries a man's world the other way out, as wraith, as far, as a digging out of the magnified man I offer forth, quote, he has filled the hungry with good things. Say this poem slanders and begs. Sucks teeth and claps loud. Walks our bare feet through the yard to the pool. All I see is dust and trees, an idea of death or the ghost of owning. Comes soft or rain through the motion sensor light, and I'm sorry because I'm happy I filter the smaller waters through to what piles into words. Petitioning for a little elegance. I bend my ass to the wind, coming off the pool water, and when I stand in a long line of bodies filled. What we bear is a horse burned in Pennsylvania, white boys poured on its back and neck, accelerant and set the match to no allegory, all matter. No longer a plane of flights, a plane of movement, a plane of kinetic aptitude, of kinetic feeling. Put the pity there to stand in for one thinking the magnified could ever lope outside the reflection. Not born free, but released. The ghost of the horse on fire is the slowest thing, making its own physics. That comes with its own laws. Be thou gentle, refined in bearing. And I'll close with this poem called Crease. Both the actual horse on fire and its event out of these words, fallen and folded back through love, trying not to be with, but of. Gathered into petals around the trace of that touch. If I can concentrate on sex and artifice like that, to crease the outside's infinite regress, when I'm dying, actual dying will be a fold about a flower fallen. I know everyone wanted their stupid church high on a hill. But my favorite things, happy things I thought drifting down into sleep, and all the faces that afflict, laid low, I could be the paper they ravish or remember, and the end of their script. Thanks. My God. Thank you, puppy.
Hello, everyone, again. Thank you for coming for Farid's reading. And now we continue with some questions that I prepared. But I also want to thank to Chloe and to Sven and to Ryle for organizing this reading for Farid, and to Farid for coming to Brussels and reading for you guys, for us. My first question for you is, if you can describe how you choose and what the title Moon, Mirrored, and Invisible mean to you?
I'm struggling with the title of the project. It's Moon, Mirrored, Indivisible, but it seems difficult to say. Moon, Mirrored, Indivisible. But I can't find a better title, so I don't love it. A couple of things. I wanted throughout the book and throughout the project to handle embarrassing tropes, like in words, like moon and love. They actually repeat quite a lot throughout the manuscript, and I wanted to work with them and not flinch. You know this word flinch in English? I didn't want to be scared in front of those words and handling them somehow in my own way. So that's moon. Mirrored, I guess I got interested in mirroring in mirrors because of their artificiality. Plato complains about poets and mimesis, and he makes this poor young man wear a mirror on his back and walk around the marketplace, which I think is a phenomenal image. And to show that the mirror can only capture broken, unrealistic pieces of reality, and to make his point that poetry and art of representation is always going to fall short of reality. So that's his complaint. But part of the way that I think about living displacement from different nationalities, different ethnicities, different sexualities, is about not having an original, not having an original point of departure. And so mirroring then becomes more realistic than to pretend that I could speak from some originary, foundational, or even ancestral place. So I was very interested in what it would mean to just accept that one doesn't have a foundational position or root, and that one can only exist, this one being this one, I don't know about you, but this one, existing or realizing oneself more in the reflection of others, right? And in the artifice of the stories I might tell about myself, or in the artifice, the extreme artifice in some cases of the rhyming of some of these pieces, which for me was a real push in a new direction. And then Indivisible is, there's Nathaniel Mackie is up on the top shelf there, who I cited, and Nathaniel Mackie is a great influence on Fred Moten, the poet and theorist, and Fred Moten is a great influence on me. And what I've learned from Fred is to think about or look for common experiences in life that exist underneath or outside of individuation. So individuation being, right, like I come into myself as a subject and I can act upon the world and I have my name and I have my signature and I have my story. And that's all lovely, but Fred is always saying somewhere that the process of individuation is actually quite violent, and it produces a violence on something that's more originary, which is a lack of individuation, where we're more beholden to each other. So Indivisible points toward that, but then it also has the other edge that it's a very patriotic word in the United States, because it's part of it's part of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, I believe. I pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation under God, indivisible, blah, blah, blah. So there's a theoretical interest I have in being indivisible, where we're not individuated, but then there's this ironic interest in the patriotic resonance of that word in the United States. So I love all three words, but I think they make a terrible title. I don't know what else to call the book. We were thinking maybe it should be called Try and Burn This One. Like the t-shirt, yeah.
You didn't decide upon the titles yet, the final title.
No, I mean, if anyone has a better idea, I'll take it. But right now it's Moon Mirror
anyone
and Invisible.
Yeah, any suggestions?
Thank you.
My second question is that at the beginning of your manuscript, you chose to quote Alice Notley. And it says, "It's all somewhere else. No one lives in a country." So when I heard that, I thought if you could describe how this quote and perhaps Alice's work influenced you, and why did you choose this quote?
So it's from a book that's also on the shelf called In the Pines, terrific book by Alice Notley. And there's, in more generally speaking, Alice has become a hero for so many reasons. One is that when I look at her publishing trajectory when she was younger, it seems very punk rock to me. She just published. She wrote and she published, she wrote and she published. And it was once a year, once every 2 years, it came out, the books came out with the presses of friends. Some of them were hand stapled. There was not a lot of career calculation, but she was just making work and learning. And now when she looks back, she's talked about those years, those decades even, maybe 20 years, just being preparatory for her later work, like the more epic work that she makes now. And I think that's so moving that, first of all, that she's working so hard at this stage of her life. and that she has the vantage to report back to those of us who are younger, to report back what those earlier decades were like for her as an artist and what they produced, what they made available to her. So I don't work the way Alice works, but that's maybe why I desire. I think it's so romantic that she just pumped and pumped and pumped work out. But also she's the closest thing, the closest poet I've found to someone who has escaped the gravity of literature. Does that make sense? Like if literature is a field with a history, obviously, we study it and we aspire to it and we say we're people of the book and we're more educated because we love literature and we love books. There's a way in which Alice has flown so far that she's outside of the gravity of all of that. And she would tell you herself, I mean, I've heard her say to audiences, poetry is, I mean, she gets very bombastic sometimes. She says, poetry is, of course, it's the best art. Nothing comes close. Not music, not painting, nothing could ever come close, right? And it's because she's interested in the technology of the body existing long before other technologies as a way to create song and representation. And she has this beautiful line in a poem where she says, the double edge of body and breath, the double edge of body and breath. And that line has stuck with me for a long time. As an aside, I got to ask her about it once, and she said she stole it from Robert Creeley, but it doesn't exist in the poem with quotation marks. So then I stole one of her lines in this manuscript that I didn't read today, but it's buried in a poem without quotation marks. So the double edge of body and breath is an exciting way for me to think about what this instrument is and how it folds inward and outward potentially at the same time. And when I say that she's escaped the gravity of literature, obviously she's making books that are printed and that you and I hold them and we buy them in bookstores, obviously, right? But she seems to be interested in a possibility of poetry for which we have not yet created the context. We would have to hang out differently through song in smaller communities to really live the way that she writes, I think. And that's interesting to me to think about, like many of us have like a good Marxist training and we're supposedly aware of like the material conditions of production and circulation of our work and we think critically about that stuff. But what would it mean to actually organize far outside of those processes? Fred Moten again quotes one of his friends, Manolo Callahan, who says, we need to constantly revise our habits of assembly. Revise our habits of assembly. So what are the ways, our habits of coming together? And I think Alice makes work for which we haven't yet revised our habits of assembly to catch up with, in some ways, how ancient the work is that she's making.
Do you think she could be kind of like a quote-unquote forecaster of the for the poetry?
A forecaster that looks like pointing to someplace much older than
ancestral
any.
Kind of forecaster, yeah. Like going in like forward, but also looking backward.
I mean, it's on us to revise our habits of assembly. So, what would it mean? You know, what would it mean? I mean, this is not radical, right? Many people are thinking about what is community vis-a-vis art. And so it's just that question. But it's very mystical too. And I mean, I think for many of us, it's very embarrassing to say we're interested in something mystical or where the body turns into the air and where the air touches the next person.
You know, yeah, can become cringe almost.
Cringe, yeah. I mean, that's exciting. I mean, cringe, there should be some edge of cringe that maybe has possibility to it.
When you talk about cringe, that's actually something that I want to touch base to, because we sat in La Biche when Farid arrived, and so we discussed your poems, right? And you told me you wanted to overcome, quote unquote, this notion of embarrassment that we have by using the word cliche words like moon, mirror, love, or sky. So my question is, do you see your writing as a way to liberate yourself from the notion of the cringe? Or is there a cringe that fuels your writing?
I don't think I can liberate myself from cringe, internal or external. In my experience, for better or for worse, is that when I read to audiences, the best I can hope for is a somewhat confused face. I had a terrific experience once reading at a university to a large auditorium, and there was a guy in the back row who just kept doing this, you know.
So what was he doing?
He was like mimicking, like he was jerking off. I think that was his critique of the work.
Well, maybe it was.
It wasn't that energy. It wasn't flirtatious. So I can't liberate myself from cringe in the response to the work. I think that I just can't. I think I do want, in a very personal way, to write toward some new thing I haven't learned how to do yet. And so in that way, that's a little bit of liberation, right? So one of the hardest things, I said in an interview, one of the hardest things about the book was allowing myself to do very delicate rhymes, like love and of. It's an off rhyme, but it's a rhyme. And to be exposed in that way. I mean, I also do a lot of thinking in my poems, and in some poems I try to make that thinking incredibly compact. So that's my own way to, I can't get away from that habit that I have or that interest that I have. But the new thing for me was to, it's not just to betray a kind of sincerity, it's also to allow myself a certain amount of pleasure on the page. And that can be embarrassing, right? And I think about pleasure and sensory pleasure a lot through these two texts, one by James Baldwin and another one by Audre Lorde. In The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin says, he's complaining, he's being quite bitchy actually, and he complains about US American white folks, and he says, you know, something about the bread, it's so tasteless. And you can't trust a people when they have accepted such a reduced sensory experience. And he talks about the sensory. He's very careful. He has to say, hold on, I don't mean the erotic as the pornographic that people put onto quote-unquote black bodies, right, as being hypersexualized. He says, I mean the sensual and the erotic as a force of life. And I thought it was very interesting a couple of years later when I found in Audre Lorde the essay, The Uses of the Erotic as Power, by Audre Lorde. She gives this essay, she gives this as a talk at a women's conference in the 70s. And she says, it's a long argument, and she's saying stuff like, no, but we deserve our pleasure and we deserve our bodies. And what would it mean if you approached your labor, your work, your project as an artist or organizer or mother or whatever, with the same kind of pleasure that you take in falling into your bed at the end of the day? And so she's talking, and she arrives at a formulation, and she says something like, almost exactly like Baldwin, it's the force of life. That there's something in the body's ability to be sensitized that exists under categories like the pornographic or the erotic, but that she called the erotic. And so I think of that, and I think of Alice's double edge of body and breath, So what would it mean to write rhymes and syntax that allow this body, the pleasure, to sensitize itself into that double edge of body and breath, right? As a technology for perhaps entering into some exchange with others, other bodies in real time. And so that's part of the cringe that I was wanting to quote unquote liberate myself from or to step deeper into. So unlike Alice, like where Alice like would, she, one of her books, she had a class at the Poetry Project in the 1970s in Manhattan. And she said to all the students, in these, whatever, 12 weeks, we are all gonna begin and finish a book. And that's what they did. And the book that she made out of that was called, I think it's Alice Ordered Me to Be Made, is the title of the book. And so when I romanticize and I fantasize about what that was like for her, I imagine that things weren't very fast, right? And I have not figured out how to do that. So I exercise a lot of control and a lot of compulsive revision. And so in that sense, cringe is something that I manicure out of the work. So I do read it and read it and read it and wonder, like, is this too stupid? Do I need to cut it out? And so in that way, embarrassment and cringe, I operationalize it as a tool, right, in the process. So, always with a desire to be more punk and with my failure to do that.
But it also brings, I mean, your true self out alive, right?
That's a control freak, yeah.
Yeah. But it's also a way of honesty, kind of honor yourself and your own thinking, right? Not to be, like you said, Alice does that, she's faster.
Right.
But you understand your own process of working. So that's, yeah, also a way of honoring your own thinking and practice. You were born in Peru to a Syrian mother. You grew up in California and then live in Austin. Now you live and work in Tucson. Does the Tucson environment influence your way of thinking? And if so, how? What's cool and cool about Tucson for you?
You should all come visit. We have a phenomenal museum with really, really fucking smart curators, and they bring terrific work. So we had a huge show with Cecilia Vicuña just a few months ago, and she got to hang out and spend time with everyone. And the curators think a lot about poetry too. And so they did a beautiful installation of this. I know there's some Wave books there, the publisher Wave. There's a book by Lin Zhu, XU, got some long title, something about the cantilevered moon. And they did this beautiful installation in this huge hall, different ways to represent the book. I love Tucson because there's a kind of quiet at night in the desert that you can't run away from. Like, you just feel very naked in that quiet. And you can hear your own thoughts in a way, like externalized. And there's a very strong presence of saguaros, these big cacti with the arms that look like people. They only grow in the Sonoran Desert, so from northern Mexico into Arizona. So if you ever see them represented in an old film and they're pretending it's Texas, it's not Texas, or they only grow in that area. It's a very complicated place where there's a fascinating tension and history of indigenous people. The Pascua-Yaqui and the Tohono-O'odham tribes are there. The O'odham people were migratory in a circular pattern from what is now northern Mexico into Arizona. And when the two nations formalized that border, it broke the migratory cycle. So now there's Mexican O'odham and Arizona O'odham, and they don't practice the same life ways that they used to. There's a lot of human trafficking Very, very intense human trafficking across the border there. Thousands of people and drugs. So that brings all kinds of actors into the desert. In some cases, the Odom on their reservation, they'll call the federal agencies to come intervene with traffickers, which is problematic, right? But they don't want to intervene with people, with migrants being trafficked through their own land. And so they call the border patrol. So it's interesting to think about all these different relationships to land and to nation. Another type of actor that comes up in this situation is a group like No More Deaths. And they are this fairly radical group of activists who go into the desert and they leave water and food at certain stations along the migratory paths. And they're constantly in a game of cat and mouse with the federal police, right? With the border patrol. And then the fact that No More Deaths has just kind of persisted over different regimes of surveillance and policing has brought more and more radical activists to Tucson. And apparently now it's becoming a hub for anti-fascist groups that are, according to some conversations I've had, literally training for how to be in violence with the police, how to fight the police. There's a movement nationwide called Stop Cop City, which started in Atlanta. And cop cities are these multi-million-dollar developments where governments pay to create fake cities to train the police on how to fight like urban warfare. And so apparently a lot of activists with Stop Cop City are coming to live in Tucson because it's still kind of cheap also to live there. And then there's this just bizarre proximity to the FBI. There's a ton of Federal Bureau of Investigation agents, Border Patrol, and Air Force. There's a huge Air Force base, as I mentioned. I could be giving a class at the university or sitting in my backyard, and you see, you know, two fighter jets circling. And I used to think they were just training pilots, but then I learned that they very often, when you see two jets, it's like a used car sales, and it's one American pilot and one pilot from another Air Force, and they're training the foreign pilots on how to fly our old planes, because in order to continue to make money, you need to be able to sell your war machines to other nations, right? And so it's a constant flow of air assets, is the technical term. To other nations. So I live under these test flights where other nations are testing and buying airplanes. So, you know, judge for yourselves how much of any of those things are present in the poems, but those are all the things that, all the energies of living in Tucson that happen there for sure. I just want to a quick shout out to this amazing group called Colibri, started by a colleague, a forensic anthropologist. So it's another group that goes into the desert and they help families recover the bones of their loved ones who died in the desert trying to cross into the United States. They find the bones, they identify the bones, and then they do whatever the family wants to do with the bones. So like they might have a ritual, a service, some kind of memorial there. So it's a very, in that way, it's a place where a lot of the intensities of these types of conflicts are very close at hand, if you want to look at them.
Thank you. In your poem, Rhodoland, I fell in axis with John Didion's book, Play It As It Lays, wherein it's mentioned, anesthetized the pain and pleasure, the character has run out of both desires and motives, the epitome of a generation made ill by too much freedom. Do some of your poems refer to that state of an era? Is passion possible without a state of ennui? Maybe that's more abstract question, but...
Is passion possible without the state of ennui?
Yeah.
Like as a counter to it?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you guys think? It's a good question. Do you feel ennui?
Ennui?
Ennui is like...
It's very French, no?
It's like boredom, you know, the state of boredom that we might all feel like there is a lot of things going on, but at the same time, you know, we keep like scrolling on our phones and we feel like sometimes nothing makes sense. That we have too much privilege, and out of this too much privilege, there is like, you know, this blank space that you have to fill up for yourself somehow.
Like, I think I may be wrong, but like boredom, you can be bored one afternoon, but ennui is an ongoing, yeah.
Good. There was, the question was that one of Farid's poem named Rodoland felt to me connected to excerpt from Didion's book, Play It As It Lays, which describes this whole nation of people anesthetized, so they are kind of like drugged to feel, but also not to feel pain and pleasure. And I wonder if that's something that it's also present in some of your poems or...
I think in that poem it's a little bit bitchy. Like there's a quick shorthand rolling about each other, viscously having forgotten the mannered European flower code. So rolling about each other viscously is kind of a lack of friction. It's fascinating to think about us moving past each other without friction. Like how are we efficiently getting out of each other's way and efficiently trying to get around each other without catching, without getting wrapped up in each other, which can be a kind of discretion and a kind of like gentility and manners, but also can be a kind of disposability of each other. So I think in that poem, there's a shorthand, it's very fast, just two lines categorizing a whole way of life, you know? But I hope that frustration or that critique or that curiosity is like kind of peppered throughout the book. It was supposed to be like, you know, if you give this type of flower, you're suggesting this kind of relationship. And yeah. It's not completely forgotten, right? I mean, I think in the US, it's like a yellow flower. A yellow rose is more friendship, and a red rose is more romantic.
Is that something generational or like, I mean, I don't know about that.
I think it was much more important for a different generation. Like I learned about these, I guess in the US, they use French because it sounded fancy. Carte de visite. Like people would have these little business cards, but they were more like your Instagram, like in the 1800s. And like you would.
Calling
cards, exactly. Yeah. So you visit and like sit in someone's parlor and chat, and you leave your card, your calling card. And I guess you would have maybe a special dish or a special box to collect these calling cards. And so I think, yeah, there were different kind of codes of civility and manners. And that's very interesting to me. You know, like what are the... And maybe, yeah, it's like, what would it mean? This is maybe a stupid question, but like, do we show off our networks to each other? If someone visited your parlor, would they look through the other calling cards and look at all the people who had come? And is that similar to looking at your Instagram and seeing who you follow and who follows you? Is there a kind of, I mean, that's interesting to me.
Maybe it became more, I mean, we all do that. I mean, somehow if you, yeah, a lot of people do that, you know, you look at similar friends because it makes the connection kind of closer, right? We did that with a friend that we compared our searches on Instagram, what suggestions you had.
the For You page or whatever.
Yeah, or like, you know, too many shoes or too many of recipes or socks fetish or whatever, you know. So it's funny to compare those.
It's like curious to me as like someone who has been a migrant and whose family has been migratory for several generations, like what are the different unspoken codes of being well-mannered in a different place? Maybe one more question.
Yeah.
So people don't get tired.
Your poems seem to capture a certain spiritual perception of events unfolding in one's life, especially Magnificat Mirror Petition. Quoting the Gospel of Luke, you mention it, he has filled the hungry with good things, which feels similar to a type of a personal oracle. So my question is, how do you vector or navigate spirituality through a poem? Do you let it speak for itself and unravel it through you? Or there's some other process? That's my last question.
I don't know, but I think when I say that Alice Notley is one of my heroes, I think that's what I'm trying to learn. And I trust that if I stay alive and keep writing over many more years, I'll learn a little bit more of whatever that will look like in my own practice. I do think there's some very practical ways to think of spiritual intensity. Like there's this quote, maybe it's completely fake because internet, but it's Rigoberta Menchú, this Guatemalan activist from the 80s. And she says, oh, you know, Europeans made fun of Central Americans for sacrificing people to their gods, but how many people have been sacrificed to capitalism? And so if you just, who knows, maybe, like I said, maybe it's a fake quote, which would not be surprising, but it's a very practical question to think about where are the spiritual intensities and very common processes that we're all involved in, right? Like, what's, just to think about one obvious thing, like spectacle, what spectacle are we happily immersed in, or what spectacle do we choose to distract ourselves from the violence that's necessary behind the screen? And religion is not unlike that, right? There's a kind of spectacle that it can provide to distract a community, but also to create a community. So I want to think in some very deep spiritual way, like where Alice literally says, I hear my dead husband, I hear my dead brother, I hear my father. She said to me, when I turn the key into my apartment in Paris, sometimes I'll hear the voice and I go to write it down, right? And that's very powerful to me. But then very, very practically speaking, what are the more common ways that we manage intensities, but don't recognize them as intensities, as spiritual, like death and murder and wealth?
It's a good ending. Well,
thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you for coming, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was recorded and edited by Roz Del Olmo. You can find more of our past and upcoming events on our website, www.ryle.space.